many of us in Quid are Jewish, and many people in the peace movement are Jewish. There's a large peace movement in Israel. I guess the question is, which part of Israel do we here in the United States identify with?
There was never a moment when this was a movement that was cohesive and without difficulties, without argument. We're a happily diverse group, and anyone who expresses displeasure or disappointment needs to look at the history to see that we have thrived in our diversity.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Rights bills on the brink in several U.S. states, queers cry quit Palestinian persecution, and oral historian Eric Marcus describes making gay history. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending March 1st, 2003. New Mexico is on its way to becoming the 14th U.S. state to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation, as both the House and Senate passed separate bills this week. Democratic Governor Bill Richardson has promised to sign into law a final version once both the House and Senate have passed the same bill. First, about 60% of the House approved a bill introduced by Democratic representative from Albuquerque, Gail Beam, and then 53% of the Senate approved a bill introduced by Democratic senator from Albuquerque, Cisco McSorley. Both bills would amend the state's existing Human Rights Act to protect lesbi gays from discrimination in employment, housing, credit, public accommodations, and union membership. Now, supporters, led by the Coalition for Equality in New Mexico, are hoping to get the House to pass the Senate version of the bill. The House debated for only an hour before approving its bill, even though it's rejected all similar bills beginning in 1991. Senators spent 5 hours in an emotional tussle between supportive Democrats and opposing Republicans.
That struggle between the parties then continued another 3 hours before more than 58% of the senators went on to pass a gay and trans-inclusive hate crimes bill the following day. That bill, introduced by Democrat from Las Cruces Mary Jane Garcia, will next go to the House. New Mexico is currently one of only a handful of states with no law expanding penalties for any form of bias crime. Its last governor, Republican Gary Johnson, vetoed two of them.
Illinois activists who've been lobbying for civil rights protections for almost 30 years are also hoping to win enactment now that Democrats control both houses of their state legislature. Their hopes were fired this week when the state Senate Executive Committee, which the group Equality Illinois calls the most conservative committee in the Illinois Senate, for the first time ever approved a bill to add sexual orientation and gender identity to the state's Human Rights Act. That law covers employment, housing, credit, and public accommodations. It was strictly a party-line vote, with 8 Democrats supporting and 5 Republicans opposing the bill, introduced by Democratic Senator from Edgewater, Carol Ronan. The bill will move next to the Senate floor, where its success is by no means assured. Democratic Governor Rod Blagojevich has been a vocal supporter.
But civil rights bills have failed in Nebraska and Hawaii. Gay supportive Nebraska State Senator from Omaha, Ernie Chambers, last week reintroduced a bill to prohibit employment discrimination based on sexual orientation, only to see it rejected immediately in committee. Chambers plans to try again this legislative session, vowing to do whatever it takes to win passage.
Hawaii bills in both the state House and Senate to add sexual orientation to the state's law against discrimination in housing and real estate transactions fell victim to a legislative deadline this week. Another Hawaii bill to add gender identity or expression to the victim categories in the state's hate crimes law passed a Senate committee this week and moves next to the Senate floor.
And remarkably, the Utah State House of Representatives this week narrowly passed a hate crimes bill, including sexual orientation among its victim categories. The margin of success was just 3 votes, and the very next day, a move to reconsider the same bill succeeded by a single vote. For 6 years, similar bills have failed in a state legislature which has enacted specifically anti-gay laws. And surprisingly, the powerful Utah-based Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, commonly known as the Mormons, broke with its long history of combating gay-friendly legislation to actually issue a formal statement that it did not oppose the bill introduced by Democratic representative from Salt Lake City, David Litvak. The statement said, "The church abhors all hate crimes. The church's well-known opposition to attempts to legalize same-gender marriage should never be interpreted as justification for hatred, intolerance, or abuse of those who profess homosexual tendencies, either individually or as a group." A church-owned radio station, television station, and newspaper went even farther, editorializing for prompt passage.
In California, suspects entered guilty pleas this week in two notorious murder cases that are emblematic of hate crimes against gays and transgenders. One of the four suspects charged with the grisly October murder of young Newark trans woman Gwen Araujo has struck a deal with prosecutors. Jaron Nabors pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter this week and will be sentenced to 11 years imprisonment in exchange for testifying against his friends, the other three suspects, in their murder trial. It was Nabors who led police to the body of Araujo, who was 17 when she was beaten, bound, strangled, and buried in the Sierra foothills after the men who had engaged in sex with her learned that she had male genitals. Araujo's death was marked by a number of demonstrations and created a new level of awareness of transgender issues in her conservative San Francisco Bay Area.
Tyler Williams admitted to shooting gay couple Gary Mattson and Winfield Mauder in 1999 as they slept in their home in Happy Valley. In return for pleading guilty, Williams will be sentenced to 25 years to life rather than facing a possible death penalty. White supremacist Williams was joined in that slaying, as well as in the massive firebombings of three synagogues, by his brother Matthew Williams, but Matthew killed himself while in jail. Victims Mattson and Mauder were well-known and well-liked in their rural Northern California community, and their deaths sparked active organizing against hate violence in the Redding area.
Domestic partners of Iowa's state employees, including same-gender partners, are set to receive spousal health and dental coverage for the first time in July. That's part of the union contract the state ratified this week with the state's branch of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. The Iowa legislature can't change the contract terms, although it may not approve full funding for the plan when it comes up later this year. The ratification was made public on the same day that an Iowa Senate committee considered a bill to specifically prohibit gays and lesbians from serving as adoptive or foster parents. No vote was taken, and it's not clear if one will be scheduled before the end of the legislative session.
Back in Illinois, Tom Tunney became the first open gay to be elected to Chicago's Board of Aldermen, winning 59% of the 44th Ward vote this week against four challengers. Tunney had become Chicago's first openly gay city councilor when he was appointed by Mayor Richard Daley to fill a vacancy in January.
Last week, openly gay president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, Tom Ammiano, announced he'll be running for mayor of San Francisco in November. Longtime gay-friendly Mayor Willie Brown, whom Ammiano forced into a runoff in 1999 with just a write-in campaign, won't be running again because of term limits, but at least eight others will, including openly lesbian city treasurer Susan Leal.
A more surprising declaration of candidacy came this week in Tokyo, where trans woman Aya Kamikawa is running as an independent for a seat in the Setagaya Ward Assembly. Her campaign is in large part an effort to raise public awareness of the status of transsexuals in Japan who cannot legally alter their official registration to show their post-surgical gender.
And there's another openly gay member of parliament in Britain after Clive Betts publicly came out this week in an exclusive interview with the tabloid The Star. Betts, a former Labour Party whip who has been representing Sheffield Attercliffe for more than a decade, has a gay-supportive voting record, and his sexual orientation was already known to many of his friends and colleagues. But after Betts' announcement, the tabloid Sun printed a luridly detailed front-page story that some activists labeled homophobic and which led a number of MPs to criticize the press for intruding on his privacy. Betts had applied for a House of Commons pass for his boyfriend, Jose Gasparo, a young Brazilian he had hired as a research assistant. The Sun reported that Gasparo's photo appears on the website of a gay escort service and said Betts had hired him through the service. Betts' version is that he met Gasparo socially and learned later on that he had previously worked as an escort. Betts also said he'd terminated Gasparo's research job when they became close. Metropolitan Police routinely perform security checks on applicants for commons passes, but reportedly MI5 is investigating Gasparo as well because of the security risk presented by his foreign citizenship. In the wake of the controversy, Betts dropped the application for Gasparo's pass.
And finally, despite last year's bankruptcy and reorganization, despite the recent name change and its recanting, despite the lack of the accustomed live TV coverage, and despite a high terror alert forcing intensive security measures, the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras held its 25th annual march this weekend before hundreds of thousands of cheering spectators. While Mardi Gras organizers continue to pursue serious political goals of equality legislation in the state of New South Wales, the glitz and fun stole the spotlight. Openly gay rugby star Coombe actor Ian Roberts led off the march with the traditional Dykes on Bikes and their less traditional gay male counterparts. Even with a much smaller budget than recent years' parades, there were 5,000 to 6,000 marchers and 140 floats. A group of Virginia Woolf impersonators with outrageous fake noses poked fun at Nicole Kidman's performance in the film The Hours. And a colorful mock tank surrounded by mustachioed dancers was entitled Madame Saddam and Her Weapons of Mass Seduction.
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 1st, 2003. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
It's longer, delves deeper, and gets better with age. A gay historian discusses his updated oral history of the movement later in the program. The myriad Middle East crises clearly have political ramifications around the world, and it's not news that the issues create rifts even among progressive activists. QUIT, Queers Undermining Israeli Terrorism, is engaged in an effort to support the Palestinian cause by getting U.S. businesses and governments to divest their financial interests in Israel. Members of QUIT took part in a controversial boycott of Rainbow, a collectively owned San Francisco grocery store, over whether the store should sell Israeli-made products. That action brought out demonstrators on both sides of the issue. Mindy Spatt, Jack Tilney, and Deej Gold discuss QUIT's pro-Palestinian perspective.
So, what is this boycott all about?
Well, it's part of a larger effort going on throughout this country and internationally to stop various stores from selling Israeli goods because the money that is paid for export taxes on those goods is being used basically to shoot innocent Palestinian people, to deprive them of their homes and livelihoods.
Is this part of the divestment campaign?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it is, and that campaign is one that has been very strong here in the Bay Area. Activists have been lobbying the Berkeley City Council to divest from Israel, and there have been some movements, I believe, on the UC Berkeley campus as well. This is our way of saying, especially to our local institutions, Rainbow is a collective grocery store here that's been involved in many political struggles over the years, and we from QUIT felt that as a part of the community that we could approach them and ask them to support Palestinian rights, which means not carrying Israeli products.
So are there other groups involved in this boycott?
Yeah, a number of groups have been involved in the divestment campaign as a whole, both general peace organizations, organizations within Israel itself have been beginning to call for a boycott of goods. Just a month or two ago, a number of academics within Israel has been calling for a boycott of academic institutions until the occupation ends. And within the United States, there have been peace groups, feminist groups, groups from different communities, the African American community, the Latino community, etc., who have been supporting divestment from Israel. That divestment includes not doing business with Israel until they end their occupation, which is illegal under international law, of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The right of return for refugees, which is also part of international law under the United Nations Resolution 194, as well as the UN Charter. And finally, an end to the apartheid nature of the State of Israel. We call it an apartheid state because Israel has a number of laws which privileges one group of people, Jews over non-Jews under Israeli law. This involves, for example, not allowing non-Jews to own or lease land. Over 90% of the land within the 1967 borders of Israel cannot be owned or leased by non-Jews, even though the Palestinian minority within Israel makes up 20% of the population. Within the occupied territories itself, the Palestinian population there has absolutely no rights and are subject to Israeli military orders exclusively. Their land can be confiscated at will for the construction of settlements, again illegal, for the construction of bypass roads, which can be used by Israeli Jews only, for the uprooting of olive groves and the destruction of agricultural land. And so we've been protesting our government's support of Israel through the divestment campaign.
Isn't it anti-Semitic to oppose Israel?
Well, that's an argument that's certainly used to attack the pro-Palestinian movement a lot, and one that I, as a Jewish lesbian, am particularly sensitive to. Many of us in Quit are Jewish, and many people in the peace movement are Jewish. There's a large peace movement in Israel. I guess the question is, which part of Israel do we here in the United States identify with? Do we identify with a repressive and violent government, or do we identify with the forces that are pushing for peace? We, as queers, we very much want to identify with the Israeli peace movement. We want to encourage others in our community to identify with and support those Israeli queers who are also fighting for peace in the region.
So what else has Quit been doing?
Quit's participated in a number of actions around the Israel-Palestinian conflict, as well as around the Middle East in general. We'll be mobilizing against the impending war in Iraq. We've also held demonstrations in solidarity with gays in Egypt who had been arbitrarily imprisoned within the last year or so, and their trials are continuing.
What about the claim that Israel is the only true democracy in the Middle East and that Israel has granted rights to gay people?
That's very well true. Israel may have more democratic rights, certainly, than other states in the Middle East, but that also has to be looked at the context of what we were just talking about, the apartheid nature of the state. South Africa, during its apartheid rule, could be considered a democracy in the sense that all white South Africans certainly had rights, as you could certainly say the same thing about the United States during prior to the civil rights movement, where it was called a democracy, even though people were African Americans and other minorities fell under rules of separate but equal and outright apartheid and discrimination in housing and education and all kinds of things. Modern Israel is continuing policies which both the United States and South Africa discarded long ago, and which the international community has rejected as oppressive and certainly unworthy of any state which wishes to call itself a democracy.
But isn't Israel a better place for queers?
Well, I suppose it is for Jewish queers, but certainly not for Palestinian queers. It's not as if being queer would prevent you from being treated the way other Palestinians are, from being stopped at checkpoints, from being prevented to work. It's not as if you'd be allowed to have a passport, which most Palestinians don't have. I mean, I think it's really important that we in the gay community not have tunnel vision and not see all issues through a narrow frame of how does it affect us as gay people. I mean, we're living on this earth with everyone else, and I think what we want to see is freedom for everybody.
Those were San Francisco activists Mindy Spatt, Jack Tilney, and Deej Gold of Quit, Queers Undermining Israeli Terrorism.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Over 10 years ago, author Eric Marcus published Making History, the story of the gay rights movement as told by the people who were there. In a new and improved edition, renamed Making Gay History, Marcus revises and expands the story of GLBT lives from the early 1950s to post-9/11. This Way Out's Steve Pride talked with Marcus about his updated queer chronicle.
History never looks like history when you're living through it. Events today may be pivotal in the chronicles that are written tomorrow, but one thing is certain. Anything we do now is constructed on the foundation laid down by the gay men and lesbians who came before us. Author Eric Marcus chronicles their stories and the stories of a movement in his book, Making Gay History, The Half-Century Fight for Lesbian and Gay Equal Rights.
I'm Eric Marcus. The book came about when an editor at HarperCollins called me and asked if I would write a history of the gay rights movement, an oral history. I faced an enormous challenge when I started researching this book because there were so many people to choose from. My criteria was simple. The story had to be interesting. The person I was interviewing had to be able to tell a story. An oral history is storytelling, essentially. And I was more interested in talking to people who hadn't been talked to many times before. People who've been interviewed over and over again tend to tell the same story every time, and the story sometimes grows more elaborate over time. And when you ask two people to tell the same story, you get many different perspectives. And what was fun was asking people about the same events and hearing the different perspectives. So, for example, when I talk in the book about the Stonewall Riot, or at least when the people I interviewed talk about the Stonewall Riot, there are four or five people who meet at that point in the book, who you've met at earlier places in the book, and you get to hear about Stonewall from different perspectives. So my hope is that through the stories of these different people, we get a truer look at what actually happened at Stonewall.
For every person, there is a point of view, and one challenge faced by author Eric Marcus was separating fact from legend. As Napoleon once said, history is only the version of past events that people have decided to agree upon.
For example, Ray Sylvia Rivera, a drag queen who was there at the time, who might be called a transgendered person today or a transvestite, but he called himself a drag queen. The popular account of Stonewall is that a bunch of drag queens fought back against police repression on the night of June 27, 1969. There was a riot, and out of that riot grew the gay rights movement. Ray was quick to point out that the Stonewall was not the drag queen bar. That was the Washington Square bar, which was somewhere else, and that there were very few drag queens at Stonewall the night of the riot. When I started work on this book, I assumed the gay rights movement began in 1969 and was shocked to learn. In fact, the gay rights movement began, obviously, years before, in 1950. And following the riot, there was a meeting called by the Mattachine Society and the Daughters of Bilitis. The Mattachine Society of New York dates back to Los Angeles in 1950. The Daughters of Bilitis dates back to 1955 in San Francisco. So it was out of these two organizations that the new gay rights movement was born. But it couldn't have been born, or at least it couldn't have progressed in the way it did with the founding of the Gay Liberation Front, an organization that spread across the country like Queer Nation did in the late 80s and early 90s. The movement could not have developed in that way if there hadn't been a pretty solid foundation created by these earlier organizations. So the myth of this single event leading to a movement is really a myth. And the story that it was led by drag queens who were indeed participants in this riot, but that it was led by and that it was all drag queens is also a myth, which is not to discount the role of men who dressed as women or women who were butch or any of the other people who were involved. This is what happened, and it's important to know what happened because the myth is not nearly as interesting or as rich as the story of what actually happened at Stonewall that night and in the nights that followed in June of 1969.
According to Eric Marcus, today we often gloss over the difficulties post-Stonewall, pre-AIDS. It was a time when the differences between gay men and lesbians sometimes overshadowed the shared battle.
There has been infighting in the gay rights movement ever since the beginning between the men who thought that the effeminate men shouldn't be allowed in, or the effeminate men who thought that the butch men were just putting on an act, between the men and women, the women who were very upset with the men for, as one woman put it, their bathroom habits, because the men were getting arrested in the bathrooms having sex with each other. There was never a moment when this was a movement that was cohesive and without difficulties, without argument. This is an incredibly diverse movement, and I think one of the strengths of it is that it is diverse. Today, there are organizations to satisfy almost everyone. I hear complaints from people saying, the Human Rights Campaign does not represent my views. Why do they speak for the gay community? Well, the Human Rights Campaign speaks for a large segment of the gay and lesbian population in America. They speak for their constituents, for their members. If you're not happy with HRC, join Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, or your local chapter of GLSEN, or PFLAG, or Gay Men's Leather Group, or whatever it is you're interested in, you can find today. But there's no one group that will speak for all of us, and there's no one group that should. I see that as a strength. The conflict is natural. We come from such diverse backgrounds. Why would we all think in one way? I remember in the 1970s when San Francisco's Castro Street was at its peak, all gay men had to wear, or they were supposed to wear, at least I got, those are the instructions I got in the mail, Lacoste shirts. If not Lacoste shirts, then flannel shirts, jeans, preferably tight, work boots, He had to have a mustache. And men who had brown hair and chest hair were most esteemed. Now you can't have any body hair, and you should have blonde hair and be blue-eyed and young, preferably. It's not nearly as rigid now as it was then. We're a happily diverse group, and anyone who expresses displeasure or disappointment needs to look at the history to see that we have thrived in our diversity, and that will never change.
Marcus spoke with over 100 people, and 63 interviews are included in the book.
I wish I could have talked to more people, but sometimes you could get things confirmed in other ways. Frank Kameny, who was the founder of Washington Mattachine in 1961, gave an account of what happened, how the organization came to be. I was then able to look at the FBI records, because there were FBI agents who showed up at these meetings and who kept records. Randy Schiltz, the late famous journalist who wrote And the Band Played On, lent me his FBI files, so I was able to read about the accounts from the perspective of the FBI. And everything that Frank Kameny said was confirmed by the FBI files. And when that happened, it was so exciting. Or when somebody I was interviewing would talk about something that somebody else had talked about and confirmed what I had heard. Those were often serendipitous crossings of history where people came together. So I didn't set out to have the stories interlink, but almost magically, people's lives crossed paths in the course of this book.
It's a cliche that those who ignore history are bound to repeat it. It is also true. But before we can learn from gay and lesbian history, we must just learn.
I think this is a subject that should be taught, that should be introduced to young people, just as we teach about the Black Civil Rights Movement, as we talk about the women's movement in history classes. It's still not easy to be a gay and lesbian person in America today. And I think it's very important for all gay and lesbian people to know about this history because they can draw inspiration from it.
For more information on Making Gay History or other books by Eric Marcus, point your internet browser to www.ericmarcus.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Barney Frank, AIDS, Quilt, ACT UP, Randy Schiltz, Queer Nation, Maplethorpe, AZT, Amendment 2, Cracker Barrel, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, HX, Cyber Sex, March on DC, Greg Louganis, Elton John, George Michael, what is going on? Lilith Fair, Rowdy Girls, spend a day at Disney World, Coonan and Scare them, Nick the Case, Ian Allen, Will and Grace, Matthew Shepard, God bless you, what else can we look forward to? Pride, pride, gotta have pride. We've been around too long to keep it inside. Pride, can't sit back and watch from the side. Pride is power and power is pride.
Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Rex Walkner, Chris Ambage, and Steve Pride contributed program material. John Gilbert Levitt performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some of This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air and get some queer audio history and timeless music in the bargain, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thank you for listening. I'm 2TLC Yamba, New South Wales, 4NAG Yeppoon, Queensland, 5KIX Kangaroo Island, South Australia, and more than 135 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.